This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location. We're on Zoom with Jericho Brown, activist, poet, professor, who holds the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for 2020 for the tradition. Jericho, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Grace.
Celebrating Gay Pride with you. And You're really busy, aren't you?
Yeah, it's been a pretty busy month and a half, I would say, yes.
A month and a half. And are you Zooming a lot?
I'm Zooming all the time.
Like three times a day?
Like four or five times a day.
We love you.
The first week that when I won the prize, I talked to no less than seven reporters a day. And right after, and that included sometimes four Zooms in a day. And now we're doing online teaching training where I teach at Emory University, because we might end up, everyone might, even if you're meeting in person in the fall when things begin, you might end up having to teach remotely again. So they're preparing us so that we're not doing it in a way that leads to us not having accreditation. So I've been very busy.
Nobody loves you more than we do right now, right here. So let's have an opening poem.
Oh, an opening poem, sure. I'll read the poems that you asked me to read too, Grace. I'll just stick to that, okay?
Sure.
And I'll read them in the order that you put them. So I'll read The Tradition first, which is the title poem. The Tradition. Aster nasturtium delphinium. We thought fingers in dirt meant it was our dirt. Learning names in heat. In elements classical philosophers said could change us. Stargazer, foxglove. Summer seemed to bloom against the will of the sun, which news reports claimed flamed hotter on this planet than when our dead fathers wiped sweat from their necks. Cosmos, baby's breath. Men like me and my brothers filmed what we planted for proof we existed before too late. Sped the video to see blossoms brought in seconds, colors you expect in poems where the world ends. Everything cut down. John Crawford, Eric Garner, Mike Brown.
The voice of Jericho Brown. Many names to add to that list. And he's so good to be with us. Lots of people want to know a little bit about you behind the scenes. So tell me about that poem. When was it that you got the idea for the poem? And did it incubate a little bit inside of you? What triggered it? What actually triggered the sitting down and writing of that poem?
I wrote the poem, if I recall correctly, I wrote the poem after having seen these deaths occur, but it was in my head that when these things were happening and I was watching them on the news and seeing things unfold on social media, you know, and it's around the same time of Tamir Rice's death. It's after so many other deaths that I experienced as a kid growing up and as a grown man, just seeing these things go by. And police always come back with no indictment or not guilty. Usually no indictment, because we never get to the point of the not guilty, right? So I was thinking I wouldn't write a poem about it because it was so present in a way that I never thought I would have enough time to reflect. By that, what I mean is it happens so often in my life that you never get the opportunity to be away from it. But I moved here in 2012. I live in Atlanta, and I was working on my flower bed in front of my yard. And neighbors, this is the first neighborhood I ever lived in where my neighbors would come by and they would bring casseroles with raisins in them. It was so different. And I was working on the flower bed, and one of my neighbors walked up. She walked right past me and rang the doorbell. And she sort of like turned around and, you know, was adjusting herself and dealing with the heat and sighing and waiting, and I was sitting, you know, I was kneeling right there. And I said, hi, can I help you? And she said, oh, I'm just looking for the man or the woman of the house. And I said, it's me. And she had this look of she had this look on her face of a kind of embarrassment. And I sort of understood in that moment what had gone on. And that happened in 2012. So when these murders went on in 2014 and 15 and 16, I remember that. And that's what gave me what I needed to write the poem. There were these separate events that somehow came together.
But yeah. Then people want to know, well, how do you go about it? Maya Angelou said every time she sat down before a blank piece of paper, she didn't know how to write a poem. And I think we're all that way. With you, it was like Genesis, you know, the naming of things. But then did you like run a film in your mind? Did you write margin to margin like a narrative? Did you collect images as you were going through the day? How did all that put together?
You know, I usually work on lines by their sound. I usually write lines because I like how things sound. I think images are necessary in poems, but I don't work from image first, and I don't sit down trying to make images. I simply write lines that I think have a certain sound quality that for whatever reason is attractive to me rhythmically. And then I put them together and I start using what I know about craft after writing those lines. You know, this poem at some point was 30 something lines long. A year later, it was a sonnet. And when it appeared for the first time a year later, after the first draft of the poem, when it was 30 something lines long, when it appeared, by the time it came out, it was a sonnet, you know, with rhymes and rhythm and pentameter. And there's a way that, I make use of that over time. But the big thing I think to know about my writing process is just that I don't rush anything, Grace. I always think when I have a poem, I'm excited and I think, oh, this will be my little baby for a little while. And sometimes a little while is 4 years. Sometimes it's 10 years. Sometimes it's only a couple months. You know, there are poems I've written that came pretty quickly, but they are few. You know, I just sort of sit with them and I revisit them over time.
You're giving craft a good name, though. You're giving craft a good name. Yeah. Form. Yeah. You are really taking form and owning it. And that is a whole fresh look.
Yeah, I'm interested in form and in subverting form and in using everything that's been given to me from the past and repurposing what's been given to me from the past, because I know the past didn't imagine me. I know the past didn't imagine me making use of it in these ways. And so therefore, it's my job not just to use it, but also to repurpose it, is the way I see it. And that's how the duplexes came to be. And that's how so many of these sonnets in the tradition came to be.
The past did not imagine you, but you are a historian of the present. Let's have another poem.
Yeah, sure. I'll read another elegy.
Jericho Brown is here. He is the winner of so many awards. His first book, Peace, won the American Book Award, not bad to start with. His second book, The New Testament, won the Ainsfield Wolf Book Award. His third collection, as we said, won the Pulitzer Prize. He, in addition, has won the Patterson Prize. He's won the Whiting Award. He's had fellowships from NEA, from Guggenheim. He's had fellowships to Harvard and beyond. He is a working poet.
I'm a working poet, that's true.
In touch with the divine.
Thank you.
Let's hear it.
Okay. This is a poem called Another Elegy. Another Elegy. This is what your dying looks like. You believe in the sun. I believe I can't love you. Always be closing, said our favorite professor before he let the gun go off in his mouth. I turned 29. The way any man turns in his sleep, unaware of the earth moving beneath him, its plates in their places, a dated disagreement. Let's fight it out, baby. You have only so long left, a man turning in his sleep. So I take a picture. I won't look at it, of course. It's his bad side, his Mr. Hyde, the hole in a husband's head, the O of his wife's mouth. Every night I take a pill Miss one and I'm gone. Miss two and we're through. Hotels bore me unless I get a mountain view. A room in which my cell won't work and there's nothing to do but see the sun go down into the ground that cradles us as any coffin can.
The voice of Jericho Brown, as Bruce Weigel said, say it clearly and make it beautiful.
Yeah, I love Bruce Weigel's poem, too.
Yeah, really.
When the morning doves fail to mate, I'm sort of mixing up the title, but there's this beautiful poem about this breakup. And the first part of the poem, he describes these morning doves doing everything they can to mate. It's so beautiful. And then in the second part of the poem, he talks about what ultimately seems like a divorce. It's really beautiful.
It is. He is too little. He's underserved. So I'm glad we're saying his name out loud. He'll hear about that. You are an academic. You are a professor. You are in the world. You're at Emory, ahead of the creative writing department. So what about these kids coming in? Are they connected? Are they awake? Are they in touch with their culture? How do you describe what you're seeing?
I think they're more, well, I'm not teaching right now. I'll be teaching again in the fall. But the students that I had in the spring, and the students that I've had over the past couple of years, I think the past few years, they are more and more connected than I ever was at their age.
What were you like at 19 walking in?
Yeah, they're more and more interested in culture. They're more and more interested in preserving their planet. What I love about students at Emory is if they see me put something in the wrong bin, they will stop me and tell me, no, Dr. Brown, that goes in aluminum. So, which probably tells you what I'm eating and drinking. Anyway, so I love them and I love that they, and you know, especially I think the young people who show up for poetry courses want the magic. And they want to believe that words have power, that language is material. And they want to believe that their words actually can do something to affect change in people's hearts and all over the land. So I...
The ground has already softened. The ground has already softened, isn't it?
Yeah. You know what they have that I didn't have, Grace? They have language that we just didn't... I didn't have words. I didn't have phrases like... sexual coercion, and I didn't have phrases or words like microaggression. And if I had had that language when I was growing up, I would have been better served, and I would have understood that I wasn't losing my mind, that things were actually happening around me that were important and that I should take note of them. And they are much more observant of what's happening in the world because they have the language for that kind of observation.
That is very interesting. What is the one thing that you would love to have them remember that you said when they leave? What would you wish that they would take away from you? If it was only one thing, what would it be?
What would it be?
It's hard to narrow down because, you know, I'm a college professor and we say a lot.
Yes.
But one of the things that I tell them is to never say no. Because that's what Nikki Giovanni told me about 25 years ago. And so I think part of the life I live has to do with the fact that I've never said no. And that's what, when Nikki Giovanni told me that, I realized when I was teaching that I would have to morph it a little bit. So I always tell them, never say no, but use condoms unless you have another plan. So, but I think it's a good idea.
That may be something you could be remembered for sure. I'm sure. And I wonder what they will say of you. What do you think?
They'll probably just say that I was always the last teacher to turn in their grades because it takes me that long to grade. they'll probably also say that I'm the teacher they saw the most. Every time a student in my class is workshopped, they have one-on-one office hours with me.
That is so great. That's awesome. Yeah. Let's have another poem. This is Jericho Brown. He's everything in the world, but to us, he's ours right now and here, celebrating gay pride, giving us his time, his energy, the man with a million-dollar smile.
Right. This is a poem called Labor. Labor. I spent what light Saturday sent sweating. and learned to cuss cutting grass for women kind enough to say they couldn't tell the damn difference between their mowed lawns and their vacuumed carpets, just before handing over a $5 bill rolled tighter than a joint and asking me in to change a few light bulbs. I called those women old because they wouldn't move out of a chair without my help or walk without a hand at the base of their backs. I called them old, and they must have been. They're all dead now, dead and in the earth I once tended. The loneliest people have the earth to love, and not one friend their own age, only mothers to baby them, and big sisters to boss them around. Women they want to please and pray for the chance to say please to. I don't do that kind of work anymore. My job is to look at the childhood I hated and say I once had something to do with my hands.
I would love to have seen you as a five-year-old. What was that five-year-old child like? How did you understand the world through language? I know as a child that language was the way I could make sense of the confusion. Was that the way it was with you?
Well, I don't know if I thought that that language helped me make sense of confusion, but I did find it delightful. I thought rhyme was so pleasurable. I remember when I first figured out that words rhymed, and I would not stop. I was like, time, fine, line, crime. I mean, I think I learned words just because I wanted sounds that sounded like words. And through that, I would make my mouth say words that I otherwise would not have known because of rhyme. And I remember listening to people talk and being excited about how they sounded, you know? Even in arguments, I'd be like, wow, he really told her. Whoa, she really told him back. You know what I mean? So I had no idea what people were talking about, but I did like how things sounded. I like the tones.
The sound. You need to write a play. I know you're a novelist, but dialogue is so cool because you love the way people talk and you have the colloquial and the classical together and you braid them together. There's a great knowledge of history and the classics and mythology in your work, but there's also the present moment, and that is what makes it Pulitzer Prize stuff. How did you know you were going to win the prize? Did someone call you on the phone? Did you think you might win it?
No, I found out right along with everybody else. Did I think I might win it? No. I mean, I always wanted to win one. I'm sort of a greedy American capitalist. I want everything. So if you know of any other award that I could possibly get, send it my way. I don't think the Pulitzer is the end of my award life. You know,
No. Howard Nemeroff said, bring them on.
Yeah, I'm for awards. I'm for what people think of as big deal publications. But, you know, I'm also for other things, too. I like to see a cute man smile. I like to get a lot of sleep. You know what I mean? I like it when I reach my burpee goal. So I have a lot of of things that I want. But do I expect them? No. Do I expect to get a good night's sleep? Not all the time. You know what I mean? Did I expect the Pulitzer Prize? No.
Who called you for the Pulitzer?
Nobody called. They still haven't called. Well, they called, but they called like 2 weeks later. You sort of find out. I found out because I was watching because I wanted to see who won and if I had won. I sort of had this idea like, oh, I have a 1 in 300. I imagine there are about, my sense from doing the National Book Award is that there are, when I was a judge, is that there are about 300 books that come out in poetry every year.
But you knew you were a finalist, right?
No, I didn't know anything. Grace, I didn't know a thing. I literally turned on to the live, you know, usually there's a press conference, but there wasn't a press conference because we're all on lockdown. And I usually turned on to the live streaming where the executive director read the names of everyone who won. And I was really excited. I heard names I knew. I heard names I didn't. And then she got the poetry. And she said my name. And I was like, oh. And then I was crying. At some point, I don't know how.
Were you all alone? Were you watching it alone?
Yeah, I was by myself. Jen Chang, the poet Jennifer Chang, had already texted me, and Pat Rosal. They had started texting me before she got to poetry. They had started texting me congrats. But when I first got Jen's congrats, I thought she was just being positive. I didn't know that I had won. I was like, what is this about? So I called her on the phone and she was like, I think you won. And I was like, really? So I didn't really believe it until they said, all of this was happening simultaneously. I did not.
Joseph Brodsky said everyone should write a Nobel Prize acceptance speech and keep it in their underwear drawer because they never know. You never know. But we know Jericho Brown. We won another poem.
I'll give you another poem. I'll give you Heart Condition. Heart Condition. I don't want to hurt a man, but I like to hear one beg. Two people touch twice a month in 10 hotels, and we call it long distance. He holds down one coast. I wander the other like any African American. Africa with its condition, and America with its condition, and black folk born in this nation content to carry half of each. I shoulder my share. My man flies to touch me. Sky on our side. Sky above his world I wish to write, which is where I go wrong. Words are a sense of sound. I get smart. My mother shakes her head. My grandmother sighs. He ain't got no sense. My grandmother is dead. She lives with me. I hear my mother shake her head over the phone. Somebody cut the cord. We have a long distance relationship. I lost half of her to a stroke. God gives to each a body. God gives everybody its pains. When pain mounts in my body, I try thinking of my white forefathers who hurt their black bastards quite legally. I hate to say it, but one pain can ease another. Doctors rather I take pills. My man wants me to see a doctor. What are you when you leave your man wanting? What am I now that I think so fondly of airplanes? What's my name? Whose is it while we make love? My lover leaves me with words I wish to write, flies from one side of a nation to the outside of our world. I don't want the world. I only want African sense of American sound. Him touching this body, aware of its pains. Greetings, earthlings. My name is slow and stumbling. I come from planet trouble. I am here to love you, uncomfortable.
I love the way you take that word wanting and turn it around on its head and make it just turn a corner on itself. And you had me at she's dead, she lives with me. That makes me cry. That's a great poem. Do you like that poem?
Yeah, I like it.
Do you like all your poems?
I don't like all of them. Sometimes a poem will come out and I'm like, what were you thinking, Jericho? but generally I like all of the poems that are in books. There are poems in magazines that I will do everything in my power to suppress to the end of time. I'm glad you asked me to read that poem, Grace, because I hadn't read these poems from the New Testament in a long time, so I'm happy to do it.
Oh, yeah. Great. We're happy. We're very happy. How important are your antecedents? How important are your ancestors?
Everything. They're everything. They're everything and nothing at all. I think about a grandfather I never met every day. I think about my mom's dad. My mom's dad had 13 kids and sent something like six of them to college, maybe seven. I don't know where he got the mind to do that. My grandfather and my grandmother were sharecroppers, and they somehow figured out how to get out of that system and to farm for themselves. And my mother grew up in a family where if you were old enough to walk, you were old enough to pick cotton. She was known throughout the region because she was very good at picking cotton. So I think about them all the time when I think about the work I'm doing, and I think about the discipline I have, and I think about them with a thank God that I haven't ever had to pick cotton, you know. So yeah, I think about them all the time.
How about your poetry ancestors, that you stand on the shoulder of your poetry ancestors? How about them in your life?
Yeah, they're, you know, in particular, when I think of people like Adrienne Rich, I think I want to honor. That's a memory that I want to honor and that I feel that we often dishonor. I have to say, you know, when things happen, like when Donald Trump gets elected, or when it becomes clear to people that that police officers make black people more vulnerable, I'm always upset at people's surprise, particularly at poets' surprise, because I know they have the same ancestors that I have. I know that they read Adrienne Rich. I know they read Amiri Baraka. I know they read Gwendolyn Brooks. I know they read Allen Ginsberg. There's not a poet in our history. There's not a poet that we love who did not understand. You know, Dickinson understood that there was a war going on when she was writing. And the poems make that clear if you read them properly. And so I find it, I think about them all the time because I'm able to do what I do because of them. And I understand that poetry is what it really is because of those poets.
Whoa.
And that's not just here, that's abroad, right? That's the Middle Eastern, you know, that's Zimborska, that's the poet. I mean, it's everywhere. You don't narrow that down.
Yeah, we draw from all of them, all that part of a fabric. Adrienne Rich says, whatever is buried is not dead.
Yeah.
No matter if it's buried, it's not dead. Let's have a final poem.
Yeah, sure. I'll read Colosseum. I like this poem.
I do too, from the New Testament.
Colosseum. I don't remember how I hurt myself. The pain mine long enough for me to lose the wound that invented it. As none of us knows the beauty of our own eyes until a man tells us they are why God made brown. Then that same man says he lives to touch the smoothest parts, suggesting our surface area can be understood by degrees of satin. Him I will follow until I am as rough outside as I am within. I cannot locate the origin of slaughter, but I know how my own feels, that I live with it and sometimes use it to get the living done. Because I am what gladiators call a man in love. Love being any reminder we survived.
I showed your photo to a spiritual leader and she said, he is serene. I showed your photo to a scientist and she said, he looks like he'd be fun to hang out with. Are both of those things true?
Am I serene? I'm not as serene as I would like to be. I'm getting more and more serene every day. And, you know, I'm very upset about having to be inside all the time, but it has given me the opportunity that I always wanted, to learn more about meditation and about prayer and about affirmation. And, I've been using this time for that. And I'm thankful for that much. I'm thankful.
That's how you do your holy work. That's the voice of Jericho Brown, and it is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I hope we can get you there in those marble halls to really honor you someday. This program is produced by Forest Wood Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We get support from the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our producer is Jack Tarashik. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.